So we're going to start that recording.
Yeah, and I think you did receive my...
I did. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Okay. Because we just thought it would be good to take care of as many as we can, and that was an easy one.
All right, so August 11th bargaining session, and Briannis is going to put up the minutes for everyone, which we'll send after the meeting, I guess. She's working on the technical stuff. Just give us a second.
All right, no problem. And
she has lost the minutes, but she will find them again. Just give her a minute.
Okay. It should not be a problem, yeah.
I saw them a second ago. I know they exist.
Yeah, I did too. I saw them in the hard copy, but...
There we go. Yep. You can make it a little bit bigger, sweetie. Hold down your control key and roll up. There you go. Roll down a little bit. Roll down so we can see. All right, good, good, good. That's fine.
Great.
And then at the very bottom has the, just so you have this here. So
that's very nice.
So we have September 11th as a Zoom. We've also, I think she's booked 395. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So 395 is also booked. You can scroll back up to the words so that they can examine those. So we're going to do both for that transitory meeting. I happen to think Zoom works pretty well for sharing proposals. It's kind of nice. But anyway, that's kind of what we were thinking for September 1st. We'll meet in person and then have the ability to have Zoom in 395. It's easy for us because we have the IT people right there and all the equipment. And I think John, if I'm thinking, he's run the equipment in both 395 and in education. So he's helped us out with technical stuff in the past. So do you need the minutes up anymore? She took them down, but I didn't know. Do you need them anymore?
It looks good to me.
No objection,
folks.
No objections here.
All right. No objections. All right. Thank you so much. I'll leave it to you then.
So should I guess the first one is ours. Should I share my screen?
That would be great. Mm-hmm. Brandis, does she have the ability? I didn't know if you said you wanted to do 9 time permitting.
No, 12 would be.
But 12 would be first. Yeah, I know. Yeah. You said 9 is time permitting. So we'll look at that. I think we'll make some good progress quickly today.
Okay, so let's see. Okay, so are you able to see?
Not quite yet, but there we go.
And you would like me to enlarge for sure, I am sure.
It actually looks pretty good size-wise to me.
Yeah, okay. That's great.
All right. Okay, so here we are. And let me put it down. And I think I should go under review and do all markup. So all markup is there.
Good.
Comments, everything is there. Okay, all right, good. Yeah, it's also showing. Okay, so this is on non-reappointment.
Are the comments showing? Because I'm seeing a little comment mark, but no comment itself.
I think we probably don't have too many comments.
Okay.
Actually, this is going to be a simple one.
Good.
Well, this is we're responding to the one that we got from you guys. Okay. And so essentially,
the comments are not showing.
Oh, they're not showing. Yes, yes, yes. So, okay. How is that?
Go up to review, maybe?
I did.
There we are. I see it.
Yeah, but that's not good. Okay. All right.
It's more of it's the margins because of the document.
I made it 150 or something. But if it's okay, I'll go back and forth.
That's fine.
Okay. All right.
Making it all smaller.
Is that okay? Okay, so basically the comment here is, and that maybe I should do that. So essentially we were, this part over here, which had to do with CNG and auxiliary appointments. And, you know, we wanted it for clarity. And I think in a way, you see me reacting to it because I do have support a couple of people who are on CNG. And so I'm kind of sensitive to that. And that's why I thought separating, or we thought separating CNG and auxiliary would be better. But we're not going to, you know, spend too much time debating that. We are fine. We can go along with what you are proposing, not to separate them. But we did feel that, you know, I mean, that the status quo here was, since you know, it is, we say upfront that university is not obligated to continue employment if funds are not available. So that pretty much does it. And then we also are saying, if practicable, then why not go back to what we had before, which is 3 or more years of and so on. So in other words, we are basically saying that we'd like to stay with status quo on this one. Okay. All right. So then ENG appointments, I guess it's the same thing. And I think you can see the, you're right. So the comments here, we talked about this already. And basically what we are saying is not the status quo as of last full book, but rather what existed before that, which was May 7th. And again, this is, you know, our position, and then we can discuss it further.
Okay.
We just think it makes sense because it gives people, and I already mentioned it last time, that the people who are really affected here, so I guess if you look at my comments, then I do have one somewhere, right, because basically the people who are affected here, this portion that we are not tenure track faculty. It's mostly instructors and lecturers. And, you know, when I was chair, one thing I realized after coming from an institution where we were always in not wanting to have instructors or lecturers, we only wanted tenure track, this is Kansas State, I realized how at UCF you could not do without instructors and lecturers. It's just the number of students that we have and the way the place is growing, we have to have them. And so I'm glad that we've got career paths for them and so on, which was also something that we worked on for a while. But I think it will be good to not take away from them the privileges that they had 3 years ago. So that's why it would be going back to status quo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I mean, we can always discuss this further. Okay. Then the one thing that was mentioned in our discussions is that if, you know, university cannot even offer a payout option if it isn't part of the bargaining of CBA. So we did include it. And all we say here, and again, if there is need, we can talk about the language, but we are basically saying that, you know, it shouldn't be one-sided. The university and the employee have to mutually agree to this offer. And as long as it's mutually agreeable, we have no problem with that.
And are those comments or are those formatting changes on the right?
The comments on the right is basically payout option to be mutually acceptable. That's all.
Okay.
Oh, the last one is we wanted to, so my comment here is, why do we need this? Because, you know, nobody's guaranteed summer employment. So why have it?
Well, if it's been offered to someone, we want to make sure they retain it for the payout. So it was protecting a summer appointment. If someone had already received their summer contract, we wanted to make sure they were paid. That it was actually a protection that was extended, not a, I agree with you. We don't have to offer one, but if one had already been offered, we wanted to protect it. Does that make sense?
Okay, so if you had said it the other way.
Well, yes, but this is also, it's clear to the employee, if you don't have one, then you don't get one. Is it necessarily? But that's kind of like the thought process, I think, on that one. I just wanted to make sure that hadn't gotten lost.
Maybe we don't have to go to a breakout room, but let me ask my colleagues right here. if we have any objection to keeping it, because that now it makes sense to me.
So, Talat, I would suggest that Charlie, the verbiage that you offered, that it would be included in your next proposal.
I could do that. I could also say, though, that I think the reason it was phrased this way is if someone has a contract and it doesn't make, that would be a reason to not offer it anyway. So that's why I think it was there. What, Sherry?
Oh, I was just going to say, we might be able to tweak the language a little bit so it's more clear what we were trying to protect people, not penalize them.
Can you be great to see it that way, you know?
Can you please roll up back to lot to the section that has the dates? I just wanted to ask a question about, there we go, right there. So one of the things that happens a lot in when we're bargaining is we only think about 9-month employees. And so I wanted to know if you'd contemplated what this means when you have someone who's on a 12-month agreement. There's this long, long time that doesn't apply well to this section. So I just wanted to make sure that you had that in mind when you are looking at this and thinking about people who are research associates and things like that. Well, research associates tend to be CNG, but they can be ENG.
Who would be examples of ENG appointments?
Typically, I would say librarian or maybe the, what are they called? The people at the creative school, something like that, that are on 12 months. I just wanted to make sure that you had that in mind and your consideration when you were looking at striking the dates.
So some of the people in Dave Pedlones' shop, the advisors, people like that, who are on, I think a lot of them are on 12 months.
The CAPS people as well.
No, because they're auxiliary. So
that's a different
thing. We have to be able to let them go if that unit's not working well.
So ENG,
with creative school is also auxiliary, but it's, I would say it's mostly research associates, scholar scientists, engineers, and librarians, and some instructors. But I just wanted to say that when we look at this, we have to keep in mind that it's not just a typical 9-month instructive faculty, which is our tendency to do, all of us, both sides.
Yeah, and May 7th was because that's when the academic year ends.
Right. But what happens is that you don't have the information from their last evaluation to be able to work, because they're not due until August. And so the September date makes much more sense. But we can when we respond,
That would be good. That would be good. We could also have two categories here.
Perhaps, and I thought about that, but really what we were looking for is, in the past, the language allowed us to give 2 semesters notice. And what we're looking for is to do that 2 semesters notice again, but to give you bright line dates so that you knew where it was and make sure that the people had that time right afterwards. So that's okay. Really what we're seeking. May 7th doesn't work at all because of the evaluation cycle.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons it was there. But I also, it doesn't make sense for a 12-month person who doesn't recognize May 7th as sort of the end. Is that
right?
And I will put that in the, you know, as something our team talks about when we respond to this. And then the same thing with that last bit with the ABC was so that there could be that 2 semester or the information so that it keeps rolling. So you don't end up with someone who gets more notice than others. And it's just, it happens to be at the time of year that they're receiving it. We're looking for fairness, that everyone gets about the same amount. And that was the logic that we put behind it. We can express that again so that you can consider that for the next proposal, since I don't think that we're going to be signing this one today. So that's fine.
That's fine. And I think we should bear in mind the differences, because it is not, you know, when one gets
a lot, can I say something real quick? Sorry. Okay. So I understand some of the rationale you said, Charlie, given, you know, the evaluation cycle and everything else. However, it's, you know, May 7th, I think, in our proposal is fair. And unlike previous years, there's the payout option. So if the university chooses not to reappoint, you know, at a later option, then they can pay them out. So,
so you're dropping the option then from the last bit, because
if the employee agrees. So
no, see, that you can't have both, Don. That's
what do you mean? Well, we have a date, and then if the university doesn't want them there and the employee doesn't want to be there, then that's an option. So, you know, I think that's, you know, there may be less issues with the dates because we have more mechanisms than we did in the past.
Well, actually we now do, but when we first set May 7th, which has been what, probably 7 or 8 years ago, we were able to pay out your entire salary. We were not limited to the 20 weeks that we are now. So this has shifted, all of these dates have shifted, and the ability to do a payout has shifted, and our ability to do a payout, even though we now have it, we've only had it restored about 2 years, and it's still less than it was originally. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff has shifted around over the years as we've been tinkering with this non-reappointment article.
So maybe we should really just look at those dates and see how they fit.
Sure.
You know, the thing is that, in my view, it would be a good idea to separate them out too. The reason is that in the employment cycle is also different. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about instructors and lecturers and librarians and others, because, you know, if you're an instructor or lecturer, you get employed in the beginning of the academic year. You know, hardly ever do you get it. So if you're given a notice in May, most likely you will, if you get a job right away, that following August, you will take it and move on, or you'll stay another year and take it and so on. So it just seemed, and you're right, I'm in my myopic view thinking also of that.
We both do it. It's so easy to do because that's our focus, and that's the majority of the unit. They're, according to my quick snapshot, I'm looking at 94 in unit, 12 month people in, you know, so that's not a lot, but we still have to account for them.
Of course.
And so what we're looking to is to go back before the bright line turned out to be an enormous problem for us. And so we're trying to give you back the 2 semesters notice so that it's fair. We end up with employees, no matter where the bright line is, if there's only one, we end up with some people getting, you know, like two semesters or the remainder of those 2 semesters, and some people getting over a year. And so it's not really, it's not falling fairly. And that's what we're striving to do. And we'll try to explain that better in our next response. But I really appreciate the insight because I'm not, you know, and again, I fall into that trap of thinking just about 9 month faculty too. And so we'll try to express that a little bit better. We'll consider breaking that up if that makes it more clear. It may or may not make it more clear.
Yeah.
So
okay.
If we intend the same for both 12 and 9, then we'll kind of revisit where we are. But thank you so much for that kind of instruction and help. So
that would be really good. And the same thing here, you know, what you can do for the last sentence. I'll leave it right now the way it is, because I do have a comment that you've seen, which is basically, why do we need this? What purpose does it serve, since summer appointment is never guaranteed to any employee? So you could make it like, if the person has been offered, then they can continue. If they have
as
not
long as it, the problem is, I didn't want to make it that whole long. If it makes and blah, blah, you know what I mean? There's a lot of ifs when it comes to summer, but we wanted to make it clear, if you don't have one, you're not getting one. That part is clear. The rest of it, we want to make sure that if we can, we want to continue that employment for the person in the
And that could be, that could be B. That could be item B.
Yeah.
Perhaps, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So folks, are we okay with it?
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, let's go ahead and move on.
Okay. All right. Okay. Then I should stop sharing. Oh, God. Just stop sharing. I have to go somewhere else. Just a second. Oh, gosh. I don't know what's happening. Just a minute. It should not take me this long, but stop share. Okay. Okay. Thanks. That's the only part that is difficult with Zoom. Share and no share.
Oh, yeah, of course. So, did we want to do 10 first, Chuck, or you? What did you want to? I can't hear you because of the whole mute thing.
Okay. I had to find my microphone there. We can do either one, 10 or 17, either way.
Hey, let me just pull up 17. It is very, very quick. And it's just a matter of basically putting it on the table. So all right, let me put it in the middle, close all these other things. Okay. And share screen. There. All right, you should be seeing Article 17, are you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So essentially, I don't want to go through and go through everything again with you. What I would like is if your team, the UFF team, would go through the document and see if there's any parts of it that could, where we could find agreement, and you can respond agreed or not so that we can find out where the points. There are some very significant changes that I don't anticipate you agreeing to. So I'm not looking for you to necessarily say, yes, we're going to do all that. But I would like to know if there's some small places where that you would agree to those small changes. Like, for instance, Chuck properly noted that if you're exactly 160 hours, there's no rules for you, for where you are. So he allowed for this slight language change to do that. That's one of the examples of something that I believe that you might accept, but if not, I'd like to know why and what the rejection is for. So it's super helpful to us to see what your thought process is. So I'm just putting this out as so it's on the table, and then you'll get an email later so that you can respond in the at the next session if that's okay with you.
Okay, so we'll review it.
Okay,
we'll
great.
Bring over.
All right, so taking that off and stop share. All right, Chuck, do you want me to drive for Article 10?
I am ready to drive right here, I think.
All right, super duper.
Is Article 10 showing?
It is now.
All right. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for sharing some thoughts of Article 10 with us. There's some things that we have found in Article 10 that we think are needed to clarify things a little bit and make this a little bit smoother. For example, on line 47, the current language just says the evaluator. And later on, the evaluator is defined as the department chair or unit head.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're suggesting is let's do that up front. The first time we refer to the department chair or unit head, that's the evaluator. And it will, I think, make it easier for the flow of this article once everybody knows that that's what that means.
Okay.
So for example, on line 144, I'm taking out the hereafter and just saying, again, it's a reminder that the department chair unit head is the evaluator. And then in line.
But
yes.
Yeah, Chuck. So when you say unit head, it's the evaluator is always the unit head, right? It is not the associate.
Yes. The way this is, yes.
Yeah.
Unless there's the chair spouse, it works for that the chair, in which case it gets elevated. So sometimes it's the evaluator is the associate dean, for instance.
So you don't want that or there, right? The or doesn't make any sense. You just say the evaluator, right?
Or unit head or the evaluator, because that could be the associate dean.
But that's the thing. That's why I was asking that can the associate dean be the evaluator? That's not correct. The associate dean may help write the evaluation, but actually it is signed by the dean.
Talat, so, if your spouse worked in your department.
Right, then it would be, right.
And it would be evaluator, which would be like an associate dean. It captures that exception.
Then you want to say, or the evaluator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it says, yeah.
Okay, Robert, did you want to say something?
Yeah, can I raise a concern? Because I see something else here. And my concern is, what if a department chair or unit head designates an evaluator that's in the BU? Is that person an evaluator according to this language?
Well, if you, Robert, we're going to address that. It's a good question that you bring up. And two lines below this, in line 146, I think we address that. Actually, it's going to be a little bit below that, but we're trying to be consistent here in line 146. It should be the evaluator can provide the extension when one is requested. I want to drop down a few more lines here. Here it is in line 153. I think this is getting at what you're saying, Robert. There are some units where the unit head is delegating to an immediate supervisor, and we're recognizing that that could happen here, that that person may be different from the evaluator, but the evaluator is going to be the department chair or the unit head, or in some cases, there'll be an exception.
Okay, so then this, again, I don't think this clears up my concern, because would an immediate supervisor be in the bargaining unit? That's my question.
I believe in some units that is possible.
Just because I believe, Robert, that in the back of the collective bargaining agreement, there's a list of positions in Appendix A, and employees in the above classification. So sometimes the person doing the evaluation is a program director, G1, and by the book, they have to be in unit. We can't take them out.
I understand that, but ultimately the responsibility falls onto the chair or the person out of unit for the evaluation, right? I mean,
they sign could, it, yes. The out of unit person will sign it.
Right. That's what I'm concerned. Like, is it clear that the ultimate person that is signing off on this is the chair out of unit person? That's my concern.
So what you're saying is that the responsibility in the end should be with the out of unit, because if there's a grievance, then the grievance is not from one employee to another.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
So I think we should make that clarification somewhere.
Okay, well, we can look at that.
Yeah.
That may be some, I understand the concern. I thank you for sharing that, Robert. And then, let's see.
This is I didn't talk to anybody yet, but if that ended up in the definitions portion, would that help?
Yeah, I think what we want to say is that the ultimate evaluator or the signatory on the evaluation is the unit head.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And then we looked at some of the changes that you had recommended to Article 10, and our preference for those is for the status quo language. We think the status quo language is better than what's proposed, but you've given us some interesting things to think about, which we did, and our conclusion was for the other changes, we would prefer the status quo language. So the changes that we're proposing for Article 10 are relatively minor. There's just a few of them. And it's with the intention of clarifying the role of the unit head, possibility that there is an immediate supervisor who is not the unit head. And I appreciate Robert's question. We can take a look and see whether there's a way to make that even clearer in this language, or as Charlie suggests, perhaps in the definitions in the appendix. So that is our response to 10.
By the way, definitions is Article 32, not the appendix, but the
okay.
it doesn't matter.
Very close to the appendix.
Yes, very, very close to it. Nestled up against it.
Yeah, this is any questions, folks? Or are we good on this? I mean, we will of course take a look. Looks good, yeah. I don't know if I should bring this up. One question that about application waste is interesting when you have transition from one chair to another, and and the ASAP is interpreted differently. And I have no idea how is clarification obtained in those cases. This is not part of what we are talking about here, but something that I just wanted to know what everyone thought about. So, you know, ASAPs provide guidelines, and those guidelines can be interpreted differently. But this is probably something maybe we can discuss at another time.
Well, Talat, that's an interesting point that you bring up. And the AESP is really a document that the faculty owns. I guess it's incumbent upon the faculty that are working on those AESPs to come up with language that's pretty clear. But it's always possible that different unit heads
I'm sure would interpret that.
Things. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It happens. But I think the way things are set up right now, if the evaluations are turned in on May 7th, a chair has an opportunity or a unit head has an opportunity to work on those and probably get them done before July 1st when there may be a change in leadership.
Change in leadership can happen actually as early as May 15th.
Well, it can happen at any time, as it turns out. But I think by and large, the majority of those take place in the middle of the summer, at the start of the fall.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm actually in that situation right now where I had my review recently by our new unit head where my previous unit head retired. Mm-hmm. I understand a lot, and I can give you my experience offline.
Yeah, we can maybe talk about it and see how we can work it so that, you know, that smoothens the process for others. Okay. So, let's see what we are on. I think we have done that. So, did you do both of yours?
No, we still have 20 to go.
Okay, great. Yeah, go ahead.
Sherry, do you want me to drive?
Yes, I do.
Okay, one second.
And I think we are very close on this one. I hope we are. We're moving on this one anyway.
Okay.
Yes, hold on just a second. Do you want me to just roll down to where there's comments?
Yeah. I think that, let me see, because I've got, okay. Let me see. Where are we?
I'm actually quite close on this.
Okay. This is the first place where I think we had a real disagreement. And we still like our language, but I will state up front that if we can agree on the rest of this article and get it off the table, we would accept status quo on this.
Okay.
Okay, keep on scrolling, Charlie. Okay, whoa. Okay. So you want to remove at the request of the grievance, and I'm not sure why. Can you explain why you would move to arbitration without getting the grievance agreement?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think, Claudia, did you want to address that?
I can. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I think we talked about it, John talked about it last time, that there might be issues that UFF as the bargaining representative has an interest in pursuing, even if a grievant may be tired of it or doesn't want to pursue it. So it's possible that UFF has an interest in pursuing to arbitration. A grievance, because UFF is the grievant, owns the grievance, it should be just UFF, the representative of UFF, to sign that.
But then why would you, I mean, that's why you have chapter grievances. And we... That's why you have chapter grievance. If you want to pursue something that maybe a grievant doesn't want or that covers more than one party, right?
Right. I think this is speeding it up, right? Rather than then filing another chapter grievance. The point is UFF owns the grievance, even if it is an individual one. This is why at the state stage of arbitration, you are you know, we're having the UFF person and Madam Moore, your lawyers, at the arbitration. So at that point, it is, even
the grievance
was,
is always at the arbitration as well, though.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it can't
be the one where the grievance wasn't at the arbitration, unless
it can't be. And sometimes they talk and sometimes they don't. The point is that the grievance, especially in arbitration, which then becomes a precedent, is a matter between the two parties that have entered the collective bargaining agreement, UFF and UCF, and their respective representatives. So even though sometimes individual grievances look for individual resolutions, it might be that and, you know, part of the reason why we get to observe grievances that are filed without our representation by non-members or things like that is because we have, as UFF has the right to observe, to see that the contract is not violated in some way, or to observe anything that has ramifications for the contract. So the grievance really is owned by UFF in that sense, as the body that is the contracting partner here.
So does that not apply then to all steps of the grievance? So if you own it at arbitration, you own it at step two, you own it at step one. I mean, a grievant brings it to you, but you wouldn't even need the grievant at any step of this, would you? If that's the rationale.
If it is about an individual, we do also sign it by the UFF representative, right?
Sure.
So, yeah. This is the recommendation only at the point of arbitration, because arbitration is a different level of legal precedent than step one or step two, right?
Yes, but from my point of view, if you're talking about something that the UFF believes is important enough to pursue without a grievant, you've now moved away from an individual's request, something that impacts that individual. Now you're into the area of a chapter grievance, and that's a different animal.
Not necessarily. I mean, this is still about a grievance in this case filed by a particular. The point here really is, do we need to get the signature, right? I mean, whether or not it's requested by the grievant or not, that's really a matter for UFF to decide. The question is, do we have to have the signature of the grievant on the arbitration form?
Mm. Okay.
Right, and that's just a one more step, which we're trying to make a little bit easier here.
Well,
Sherry, does it, so, you know, so how would it help your, if you're thinking about it, then, and you would like the grievant to be there.
I don't care if the grievant is there or not, particularly. Yeah. I just...
Well, good, then you don't, I mean, so that's what we were saying. I think at that, this is step three arbitration filing, right? This is about what happens in the process of filing that, which signatures need to be on the form. That's really what we're talking about here.
Can I say that my concern would be that don't even people who don't have the support of the UFF, say people, someone wasn't paying their dues, so that the UFF decided not to represent them, don't they still need a path to arbitration?
Yes, but even then they have to get UFF to sign the form.
We have at least one of those right now going to arbitration.
Right. And from our side, even if there is somebody who UFF is not representing, we actually do paperwork because we are the representative party. UFF is the representative party that, you know, they can represent themselves, but we still have to sign off on the form, as you know.
Well, doesn't everybody need a path to arbitration whether or not they're represented by the UFF, though? I thought by law that everybody had to have a path. Am I wrong?
This is not preventing that at all.
No, this doesn't prevent that because all this is saying is that if the grievant decides they don't want to go to arbitration,
They just want to drop it. UFF can say, well, we still do. So
yeah. Right.
By ourselves.
That's basically the idea.
That's right.
Which.
And so what I'm thinking about that is that supposing that, you know, you said, no, the grievant should be there and should sign. But and then let's say the grievant doesn't want to sign, UFF could always say, well, we'll proceed anyway. Right, we need to file it.
At that point, they would proceed as a chapter grievance.
As a chapter grievance, right. So they could just do that and say, we would do a chapter grievance. So in effect, it doesn't save any more time.
No, a UFF can have an interest if there's an individual case where an individual's rights have been violated and that has been noticed and the grievance is being pursued. At some point, the grievant might say, oh, now I don't know if I want to push, but UFF thinks that it is in the interest of enforcing the contract to see this grievance through to arbitration, that we need to have a way of doing that.
Which is the chapter grievance, no?
No, because...
Yeah. I'm looking at section 20.3 in the definitions, and it seems to me...
I don't know which way I'm going.
That the chapter could file a chapter grievance that would be initiated at step two. So it's possible that an individual would go through two steps. Perhaps the UFF would want to continue to arbitration. The individual employee might not want to. It appears to me that the union could initiate a step two. So there would be one additional step in there, but I would be concerned if there was an individual who was named in a grievance and was the original grievant, that we would be probably inclined to include them as a witness. And that may be harmful to that particular grievance if this named employee is not willing to testify. If it's a step two grievance or a chapter grievance where that person is not named, it's a general principle that the union is looking at, that might flow better. That's the non-attorneys saying that. Sherry, you might want to correct
that. The passage that you just pointed to, you're right, actually does say that the chapter grievance can be filed on behalf of an individual.
Of an individual, yeah.
That's fine.
In fact, it has to identify some group of employees.
Or an individual,
right.
Yeah. Exactly.
So again, this is simply on the part in terms of filing, right? Mm-hmm. What we're talking about in terms of who is, like, in terms of filing it and the form. So what we're saying, that the whole point of our suggested changes here is to change the form to not necessarily require the individual grievant to also sign it, but simply to have, as we have now, the director of arbitrations or the UFF president or designee sign it. Since that's really who from then on has to do all the coordinating, right?
Well, in terms of
picking the arbitrator.
I'm sorry, Claudia, I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
Picking arbitrators and all of everything from there on is really done by the whoever is the UFF director of arbitrations is.
Yeah, I think the concern was is that it continued, that by the grievant had been proposed to be struck here. So it looked like the grievant had no way to proceed if the UFF decided that they didn't like it or if they wanted to keep going. And we're reluctant to remove those rights from the grievant, I think. But we'll consider
that's very nice that you say that. But UFF is the organization that is collectively bargaining, and some individuals might not like certain things in the bargaining unit. However, it is the bargaining unit through its representatives of the bargaining team or the grievance director and team that is charged with bargaining and enforcing the contract.
So sometimes
it might be that a grievant might want to, for example, negotiate a deal that is advantageous to them, to avoid some negative impact of some violation of the contract, but UFF would obviously have a vested interest in not allowing that, but pursuing the violation to arbitration, no matter if the individual grievant in that situation before that or not.
Yeah, and I'm reading this, the grievance may be withdrawn at any time by the grievant or the statewide. So the statewide could withdraw the grievance even if the grievant wanted to pursue it when yes. you're at the stage of arbitration.
Yes.
But you already, yeah, I mean, you already have that right. I mean,
right.
there are people that I know of who are still mad at you, by the way. And one of them just filed an EEOC complaint against us. that you did not take his case all the way to arbitration. So yes, that is something you already have the right to
yes,
do.
Yes, we do, and we make decisions about that.
Yeah. Okay. This is helpful. I just wanted to get some clarity on that. All right. So on the selection of the arbitrator, I consider what you said, and I understand the problem that we've had recently with these. You know, picking these panels. And I looked at all the language in this section, and it seems to me that this section was, if you read it all the way through, it really seems to me to be applicable when you are just, when you had like your first contract and you have to get an arbitration panel put together. And we already have a good arbitration, you know, an arbitration panel that Crystal and I, and I'm assuming that she talks to other people in the state and maybe you guys, I don't know, about who they like, who they don't like. We've agreed on a panel now that we feel pretty good about. So there's no need to kind of reinvent the wheel every time we negotiate an agreement. So I changed the language to say, within 90 days after the execution of this agreement, the parties shall review the existing arbitration panel list. If either party wishes to make changes to the panel, or if an arbitrator needs to be added because of a vacancy, this last time we had two people who died, who are still on our panel, then representatives between us shall meet to make changes or additions to that list in order to maintain an arbitration panel of no fewer than 9 members. I don't think we need 10, and I think we have 9 right now. So the idea is basically, when we go through, we finish a 3-year agreement, we look at the panel and we say, okay, do we have a number we need? Anybody want to strike somebody off here that you've had a bad experience with, you know, and you want to get rid of them, or are you happy with the panel? If we both say, okay, this is fine, we'll just stay with what we got, then we don't have to do anything. And I struck the part about if we can't agree to a panel of arbitrators, because we have a panel of arbitrators that we've already agreed to, then we shall follow the normal arbitration as a selection of an arbitrator. So I like the current system that we have, as problematic as it has been, because it gives each party, UFF and UCF, agency and input. I don't like it when we just turn over our responsibilities and our rights to an outside entity and say, okay, you just give us a panel. Even when we go to impasse, and Claudia, you've been to impasse. I don't think anybody else on your team has been. You know, PERC always sends us a panel and says, pick somebody or you can pick your own. I don't think we have ever picked somebody off the panel that PERC sent us. And that's over, golly, how many impasses have we had? At least 4. Because usually the parties have a pretty good idea of who they think are, you know, it's always a sort of a guessing game. You know, well, who's really good for union? Who's really good for management? And you sort of try to put together a panel that's not too heavily weighted either way. So this was kind of my compromise on the changes that you wanted. I think this whole thing about every time you negotiate a contract, you have to get together and recreate the wheel with an arbitration panel is just kind of stupid. So
our proposal though didn't ask for for there to be a panel, right? The proposal was, I believe, I'm not sure I can see it through here, that basically the idea was if there needs to be an arbitrator selected, we meet, we come up with somebody. Now, if we happen to have a panel where people aren't dead, we could say, hey, let's pick that one. Okay. if we have another idea mutually agreed upon, we pick that one. If we can't come up with one, then we turn to a mechanism of getting a panel. So, I mean, I do hear what you're saying here as a sort of trying to work in between those things. And I think I would suggest to the bargaining team that we consider this and just take a look at it to see if that responds to those things. But I think our initial proposal wasn't, we have to go through this whole process with the Association of American Arbitration Association every time. That was really in case of conflict.
That's right.
Yeah, but under your proposal, would we just then scrap the panel that we have? Because we have a panel that we're pretty happy with.
We didn't say scrap it.
The panel is just a list of people right now, right? From which one can choose. That doesn't mean that we have to get rid of it. But it could be that we're become aware of other people that we can sort of ad hoc agree on.
Well, then I would suggest that we would add a line there and say that the parties may mutually select as the arbitrator an individual who is not a member of the arbitration panel. We can keep the line.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that was the intention. Basically,
the intention really is to speed up the process and avoid having to deal with a panel of people who are dead or not available, or, you know, that's just frustrating for everybody involved.
Yes. And that's why I did really push hard to get an updated panel. Now that we have one, I kind of like just having it because it gives us at least, here's a starting point. And these mm-hmm. nine people that we have both agreed on that we think are, on a particular type of grievance, you may not like a particular arbitrator. I may not like one that's on there for some other kind of grievance, but at least these are people that we've both said, okay, these are acceptable in most instances. But in the interim, if, somebody new comes along, there's no reason we couldn't add them, or there's no reason we can't pick off the panel. I just don't want to waste all that work that we've already gone through to get something good.
No, agreed.
I understand the concern. Yeah, thank you.
Agreed. So I think maybe what we need to do is basically have the proviso that there be this possibility of adding new people in case.
Yeah, and then we'll just
people in the panel that's already selected are not available.
Yeah, and then we can just keep this line that the parties may mutually select an individual who is not a member of the arbitration panel. I have no problem with that.
You can respond with that in the next time. I think that would be great.
Right. So why don't you, you can send it to us and then we can respond with that. But now that it's clear.
That's what we do with MPAC.
Yeah, that sounds.
We have to do that again.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Moving on along, Charlie. This was just clarifying that this is status quo, right? Yeah.
It adds to status quo. It spells out our current practice. I think if I remember correctly, the UFF's proposal said something like, why do you need this? It doesn't add anything. And so I was hoping that you or Chuck could maybe explain that this is our practice.
Well, I understand what you mean, that the arbitrator awarding employment beyond the sixth year would be in case of a tenure earning faculty, right? So something happened in the tenure process. They say, okay, yeah, you do get to try again, right? That would be the situation. If the person is granted this extension in some sense, or the second process, they are by definition tenure earning because they are in the process of earning tenure. So it doesn't make any sense to say that they are now in a non-tenure earning.
Well, Claudia, actually, appreciate what you're saying, but that's in conflict with the CBA. The CBA in Article 15 says that a decision has to be made by the end of the sixth year, period. Article 8 allows for the possibility that someone could be pre-tenure beyond that they could be, or excuse me, in Article 8, if someone is not reappointed, they can keep the title assistant professor, but they're really not on the tenure track any longer. So
how would you put in a tenure application?
You can put in the tenure application if in the seventh year or whenever but the 10-year earning period must end by the end of the sixth year, according to Article 15.
So, Chuck, that's not correct.
Let me understand.
So I'm looking.
Let me correct Chuck real quick. Go ahead.
So in tenure, in 5.2 says an employee shall normally be considered for tenure. It doesn't say absolutely. May be normally considered for tenure during their sixth year. Doesn't say anything else. By the end of the 6 years, this shall be awarded.
15.2B. Take a look at that, John, please.
But I do want to ask something here, Chuck. So supposing the person goes through the sixth year, is not given tenure, right? Then the person goes through grievance, goes through arbitration, and then the decision is what? Then let's say they win.
If they win, an arbitrator may say that there needs to be a new review, and the university will do the new review. But according to 15.2B, they are not tenure earning at that point. They may be submitting an application for tenure. Yes, I agree. But they're not tenure earning because a decision
Still submit an application.
Yes.
And still be granted tenure if they are approved.
If it's successful, yes.
It is successful. But what you're saying is that that's a special case and they're not to be categorized as tenure earning. I understand what you're saying.
Yes.
All right, Charlie, you want to scroll on down?
Sure. So we'll take a look. I think I know the sense of where you're coming from.
And I think we talked about this before here. I wasn't at the last meeting, so I may have missed something, and I wanted to make
We went through a lengthy discussion on this, and I think, Claudia, you're the one that finally said, because I have stated very clearly that the law is that we cannot refuse consideration. We can't refuse to process agreements because we think it's untimely. That's just the law. And I think we said, well, then maybe we don't need to amend this. We'll just leave it like it is, with the understanding that, you know, there's certain things that we can't do because we can't do them.
I think go to the arbitrator for arbitrability for timeliness rather than having that decision made earlier. So
we can't make that decision ourselves.
Right. So we had initially inserted language here, if I remember this correctly, that clearly stated that university does not have the right to refuse it, which Sherry said is, you know, we are agreeing on that. If you were unhappy or not willing to enter that language, we had said, well, what about just scrapping 1211B altogether and simply taking the description of the process as what we're agreeing to? Yeah. And that would not state you can't or you can. It's just simply saying, here are the forms, here's the timeliness, here's the process. And neither one of the two parties gets to make decisions that aren't really ours to make at that point.
I had understood that we were going to kind of like stick on.
I said that wrong, but yeah, but what Claudia is saying is right. We would just take out the A and then so that it's not an A and B, it's just the process. And
so maybe when you respond to this article, if you could make that plain and then maybe we can come to agreement, that would be super. So that will take care of Article 20, unless you want me to roll back to anything else?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think we're fine.
Got it. Okay. Well, we're down to, there's no updates on budget. So, did you need to talk about anything for 9-1? I think I sent you what we intend. We're planning to bring Article 13, which is a response, and Article 19, which is the first proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Fingers crossed about Article 6. If not 9-1, then definitely 9-22. Sarah's been extremely busy, and right now she's on vacation enjoying herself. So she wanted to give an experiment to whether or not she could incorporate some ideas that you talked about before in 6, and we haven't gotten to that yet, but we hope to before the end of the month in September.
Right. So I would actually prefer to move on to the COVID MOU before, and if we have time, then we can do Article 9.
Oh, it would be great to do Article 9 first so we could get all our bargaining out of the way.
Okay, well, what do you think, folks? Can we do a quick one?
I think we can do kind of like how Charlie presented Article 17 earlier. Put the proposal on the table.
Sounds great.
Okay, why don't we do that? Because that makes it easy. And so I'm trying to open that article as soon as I... Okay, it worked. So basically, let me do screen share and screen share on Article 9. Can you see my screen?
Not yet.
It's thinking about it, though. I think it says it started screen sharing. Ah, there we go.
Okay, so basically, and I'll do the same thing. So essentially, as you will see, we're very thankful for some comments, and also you should be excited because we accepted most of yours. We accepted the changes here. I think
it's very helpful to have them in writing because that makes it quicker for our side. So thank you very much for taking the time to do that. Especially John, you're so good at details. I really appreciate it.
Right. So I think the only thing, right. So basically this is where we have taken our, so we should just mention we've taken out if practicable in two places because it's already said above that, you know, all of this is contingent on various factors. So changes can always be made, right? We're talking about that. So I think we didn't see the need to have them in these two places.
I don't see it in A because it's been deleted from A. So I'm not sure. I see it.
I think we say annual assignment. Okay. Communication. Okay. At the beginning of each year, of so on and so forth, except for an assignment made at the beginning, shall notify the employee prior to the assignment shall be communicated no later than 6 weeks in advance of its starting date. I think we have above where these assignments can be changed depending on circumstances.
I don't see that there, and that ability is super important to us.
Yes, I totally understand that.
And as a former chair, I know you know how important that is. Exactly. So just letting you know that is something that I think our
exactly. team- I mean, I've had to change assignments 1 week before classes started, sometimes even 2 days before classes start.
It happens. It doesn't happen it all happens. The time, and I think the chairs do their best to get assignments as soon as they are able to comfortably. But I understand why the faculty would want their assignments so they can start working on them. I absolutely get that, but that is just so important for us to be able to pivot. So I hope you'll understand why we're interested in retaining that language.
Well, I understand that, but I think what we have, the reason we took it out is that there is a place. Now, John, you could help me with that. There
sure. is a place. So Charlie, this talks about the initial assignment. And then that
a change in the language of
this talks about the initial assignment.
Yeah.
Change it. The process to changing an assignment has not been changed.
So no, here it is.
This is just notification of your initial assignment.
So you, so if there's something, and I'm just going to throw you're at 6 weeks. So you want someone to take their best guess, have someone start working on something when they know that it's probably going to change just to meet a 6 week arbitrary deadline rather than saying, can you hold on another week?
And well, we're the only ones left with the blue book language. So it's a waiver. We're not willing to grant the waiver until let's move on.
Well, I think here it is. It says right here.
Okay, but yeah, they're talking about making changes. And I understand what you're saying about a waiver, John, but all of this is a waiver. So, I mean, we certainly could make this a lot different by changing this. This is a place where we're trying to say we're going to try to make it. And if we can't, then we need that flexibility.
So, Charlie, as a department chair, I saw both sides. I also realized as soon as the 6 week thing was first presented to me, I hated it. But I think what happened is that it actually made us get the work done
absolutely
6 weeks before. Okay, if we didn't have that deadline, if we didn't have, as a chair now, I'm speaking, if I didn't have that deadline, I probably would not have made it. But this forces chairs to make that decision. And then the changes that I made are only a few. But what was happening before I realized, again, you know, I'm talking as a chair, that there was a six-week deadline, then we sometimes would go as close as a month before. And I think it's very good to have this 6 week. You get it all clarified, and then you deal with whatever changes you need to make.
And I want to reinforce that we advise the chairs that we want them all to do it 6 weeks in advance, but sometimes it's not practicable. And all of this is a waiver. So we could make it 2 days if we wanted to. So I don't want to do that. I really like the 6 weeks because I think it's a reasonable date, but the if practicable will be difficult. But anyway, moving on.
Yes. Just a second, if I may, I think there are a couple of cases that come up where the if practicable is important. I mean, it's perfectly acceptable for a chair to provide the assignment exactly 6 weeks in advance. That's consistent with the language and certainly
or we more. Think that
And absolutely, we encourage chairs to get those in as early as they can. It can also happen that as the chair is getting close to that 6 weeks, there could be something that happens. The chair is hospitalized for some reason, and it now becomes impossible for the chair to do it on 6 weeks. We could be shutting down because a hurricane is approaching.
Yeah.
There could be a number of things that come up. We want to do this 6 weeks or more in advance, and as Charlie said, the message that our office gives to all chairs is get the assignments done. Please get them out at least 6 weeks prior to the start of the assignment. But there may be some cases where it's just not possible, rare cases where it's not possible. And if we remove that language, it's a violation of the collective
bargaining agreement
because
the
faculty member had a heart attack.
Yeah, no. Okay. Right. Why don't we,
our employee.
Maybe we want to, let's move on
let's
because maybe
move on.
We could do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think other than that, we will same thing here. The same thing about if practicable, that change in another place. And then teaching schedule, the same thing. We didn't find this to be necessary because it says to the extent possible, and that basically includes all of those. There may be other factors. And again, the same thing we did for if practicable, remove there. I think that we've added the word creative work writing because we have not just research, but for some of our employee, some of the bargaining unit members, you know, it's not research, but it is creative writing or other creative work. So we've added that.
Let me just say something real quick. As I was reading through this for the upteenth time again, we used the word creative activities above, I think, in up in 9.3A. So that may be a consideration to use creative activities and creative works based off of the feedback
right.
that we provided last time.
And if you recall, the feedback was that the creative work is understood for certain disciplines to be research, but not for others, and then it could add confusion that creative writing is something that you could add as research if it's not part of your discipline.
Okay.
Right.
Research and creative activities is the way it's put in assignment forms, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
I think creative activities would probably be better.
Okay.
Can I make the change right now?
Sure.
If that's your proposal, yeah, absolutely.
Is that okay with everyone?
Yeah, that's a catch that I didn't catch.
I think I didn't see it either.
Whoops, so. You need to track it. Track it, please.
Oh, sorry. It should have been. It should have been tracking. Uh-huh. That's interesting.
And you might want to make it research and creative activities instead of making it research, comma, because that makes it two different things rather than the same. So it's research and creative and whatever that is. Is that what it says in
Yes, it says,
I think that is.
Yeah.
It says it in A.
Yeah.
So
research and creative activities.
Right.
Yeah, that's fine. Teaching or other activities required of the employee. Yeah. Okay. All right, then I think we accepted the change there. Let's go to the next one, time limits. And I think there's no nothing to disagree here. This is a minor change from he or she to they, which we are all beginning to use.
Yes.
And then same thing about there.
That's helpful because we can put that in our
there future. Again. That's right. Several theirs. Language is something that is always.
Hey, Talat, could you scroll to 171 just for a second, just for a blink, and then you can come back down to 240 where you are right now. 171.
71, yeah.
170. Okay, I just wanted to look and see. We had made a proposal for saying 14 days instead of 30, and I just wanted to see what you didn't respond to it, but that's fine. Well, I'll take that. We'll I take it as a rejection.
We put the general comments in 9.9 in terms of all, because you made multiple requests for changes, including the 14 to 30 days, and then shortening the process or lengthening the process through the turnaround times. Instead of addressing each one, we just made the general comment at the beginning of preferring status quo for all the time limits in the ADR process.
Until just now. Okay, I apologize. Thank you. You can go back to down to 240 where you were.
Okay, no problem. No problem.
So I just wanted to see what the thought was.
Yeah, 240 something.
It's very helpful when I go through my document later. So you know, when the team goes through, we like to see it. So thank you.
I think that's it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
So I will save this and I can send you this copy. And I think I'll stop. No, I won't stop sharing. Maybe I should, but I would because I am going to. Yeah, good. Okay. So then what I should do is go over to MOU, if that's all right, or is there anything else?
Nope.
All right, so then I will open my thing and then I will share my screen. Give me a second. Yeah, okay. So I'll share my screen. All right. Share. Okay. Is that large enough?
Yes.
Once it loads.
That okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So basically, we are working off of the document that we had submitted or that we had all agreed on, that UFF and BOT had agreed on, for the memo that supposedly expired August 7th. And we're basically asking that we work on this one, which has some changes. So essentially, the preamble is the same, except for the word, one word strongly, because it is coming through CDC right now, that strongly recommends vaccination. In fact, and then we added that it's just not the coronavirus, but also its variants, because we have the Delta variant, and now what, is it the Lambda, or there's some other variant that's coming? So then the question here was the time limit, and in the last one we had August 7th. In this one we have put May 7, 2022, so we don't have to be negotiating one more again, but we also added until the federal COVID-19 pandemic disaster declaration expires or is revoked, or May 7, 2022, whichever comes first. So this just allows us to, you know, hopefully it will be before May 7th, but that's where it is. So we have added one, and maybe just to say a couple of things here before we go on to why we've added the first one. One of the things that we have noticed is that up to now, UCF is not imposing a mask mandate, right? I mean, that is the current position. And again, I say that because I'm sitting right now at a university where there is internally, locally, mask mandate. So Kansas State University has a mask mandate. in all the University of California campuses that I'm familiar with, they have mask mandate and it goes on. Not only that, but a number of these universities also have vaccination mandate. And this is something that we don't have. So if we had a mask mandate and a vaccination mandate for all individuals connected with the university, we wouldn't have the need to add the first item here. But given that, and given the fact that we have a large number of our classes or a large number of our unit members who have to face classrooms that don't have 10 or 15 students, but rather 100, sometimes 300, sometimes even 500 students, then this has been brought to our attention by our unit members that what are you guys trying to do? Do you have any moral concerns here? I mean, essentially, what we are working off of is that BOT and UFF leadership, we have the responsibility, and I would say a moral responsibility, to protect our unit members. We know that people get exposed to COVID. We know that when they get exposed to COVID, there is a finite chance that they may not recover from it. It may be fatal. It is our moral responsibility that we take every measure to make sure that safety of these individuals is our prime concern. And so that is what we are talking about here. We realize that there is a big, or not, there's a pressure to have face-to-face classes. And there's also a pressure not to have a mask mandate. Given that, what we are asking is that employees with an instructional assignment shall notify their departments of teaching modality choices based on their personal health and safety concerns and other physically present conditions. What we mean by physically present conditions is, if a person is really worried about not being in the presence of unvaccinated people, we believe that it is their prerogative to not have to face unvaccinated individuals. That's what we meant by, and there could be some other aspects too. So what we are asking is that employees make that decision. We do realize that there are unit members who want to have face-to-face classes. They are not worried about that, but there are others who are really, really scared. And we have got long letters from people with all kinds of suggestions. So we basically, what we are asking, that the decision of whether to have face-to-face encounters or remote, that be left to the employee, as long as this federal COVID-19 pandemic disaster declaration is in effect. So that would be the first one. There is related to that, we did have a question, because the latest statement that came from the provost mentioned that no one at UCF should ask anyone else whether they have been vaccinated. We would like to know where that restriction is coming from, because we have looked up HIPAA websites, other places, and basically they say it openly that asking someone whether they are vaccinated is not a violation of HIPAA. And that is because Whether you are vaccinated or not affects other people around you. This is the same thing. You know, children have to, when they go to, you know, elementary school, they have to be vaccinated. And if they're not vaccinated, they're not allowed. So this is not a privacy matter. This is really a healthcare matter. And so we would like to, and this is, we are requesting you to give us some information on this official statement by UCF that no one at UCF should ask others whether they're vaccinated. We agree that we cannot deny someone access to the classroom or we cannot tell them that they cannot be any place if they're not vaccinated. But I as a person or you as an individual can decide to be not in the presence of someone who's not vaccinated, because then that's why we need that information. So that is something that we would like to like to know.
So it's a lot.
Yeah.
You can ask me, as far as I'm concerned, whether I've been vaccinated, and I'm happy to tell you that I have. There is no, and you can choose, because right now, at least, we're Zooming to not come to my office, you know, not have lunch with me. If you ask a student in your classroom, and they have not been, and you have been assigned to teach face-to-face, what is the purpose of your asking? Because at that point, you have no, there's nothing you can do about that.
Because you could ask beforehand, because we all get access to our students, you know, roster, and we can send an email and just ask, just gauge how many of the students in the class are vaccinated, and that would help you decide whether you want to be face-to-face or remote.
But that's not an option right now.
Well, that's what we're asking. We're asking that employees
that's
be
not
given
going to be, that's not something that I can even, I mean, I have really resisted even approaching this topic of impact bargaining, because I don't have, and the university does not have and will not exercise, allow employees to determine their assignment based on whether they think the people in their, whether they know or believe that the people in their classes are vaccinated or not. So, I mean, I'm not sure what the point is.
Well, the point is that you're going to take this and you're going to, of course, come back with a response to it, right?
You asked us at consultation and you got an answer. The university has been putting out all kinds of documents saying what the university's position is. It's not going to change between now and the next time we get together for bargaining.
It may, because this is something that is being done now by other at other SUS
no SUS campus is requiring masks or vaccinations or allowing faculty or anyone else to unilaterally determine their assignment based on the status of vaccinated or unvaccinated people in their classes or in their workspace.
I think Kevin wants to answer. Kevin?
Yeah, just a simple point. There is a point or a purpose for a faculty member to know the vaccination status of people he comes face to face with. It's important for each and every one of us to be able to assess our risk at all times, to be able to assess our own safety. So I disagree with your statement that it's pointless to be able to ask. I think it's actually a very pointed and important issue to be able to ask.
Well, so the other thing,
add one more thing to Lot. The question was, what is the basis for the university's repeated statement that we are not permitted from asking students or colleagues? Because we cannot find it in the legal text of the law, of the state law. And then an additional comment, asking about the vaccination status, for example, might determine how one configures a room, how one assigns seating for, in particular contexts, mm-hmm. that people are seated in close to doors or windows or even in meetings. So it's not necessarily am I going to teach the course or not, but there are a lot of decisions that mm-hmm. are being made to ensure the safety or to lower the risk, not just of the professor, but also of other students who may have particular concerns in live classes as well. The initial question, though, was about what is the basis for the university's statement? Because we don't think it is the law, the legal text, because that does not speak of prohibiting asking student colleagues.
Okay.
There's also, you know, state colleges are requiring masks indoors, right?
The only one that I'm aware of that has so far been able to get away with that is Valencia. And they're doing that in a sleight of hand way, but which I don't think is going to hold up. But
sorry, Shay, also Seminole State. It's not just
Valencia. Seminole State initially said that they were going to mandate them. And I actually talked to their GC, who believed that his board, they was going to take it to their board of trustees to approve it and believed that they would support it. And over the weekend, the board of trustees began getting calls from the Department of Education saying, do not approve this. And so they do not have a mandate. They're doing the same thing we are, requiring, saying, you want you to, but they can't require it.
But what happens also, Sherry, if in you're in a classroom and students who are vaccinated ask that you let them know whether the person next to them is vaccinated or not? That's not against the law. I mean, you know, we are afraid to be next to people who are not vaccinated.
I understand that.
Yeah. And somehow we need to... You know, if there's no pressure from us, I don't know where the pressure is going to come from. That we need to act responsibly and morally. I mean, we are morally responsible for the lives of these people who we are basically telling people, students and faculty, that no, go and like be sitting next to all these crazy people who have not been vaccinated. You know, if we have a vaccination mandate, I think it makes sense. If you have a mask mandate, it makes sense that we go face to face.
And if you configure your classroom so that you separate out the vaccinated from the unvaccinated,
mm-hmm.
and have the vaccinated sit in one place or the unvaccinated sit closer to the doors or closer to the windows, and I've heard all kinds of things, I can tell you that because people who are unvaccinated are the ones who are the most strident about this, are going to file a complaint and claim that they are being discriminated against because they are unvaccinated, that they don't get. So, I mean, this is going to be an ugly.
They can do all they want.
Sherry, that the question though wasn't so much about what are we going to do. And, you know, there might be, depending on the class size and the matter that's being taught, there might be lots of considerations that the professor who is a professional in that field will have to consider, et cetera, et cetera. The question really was...
I understand what the question is. I'm just saying, and I will provide an answer to you, best I can, but... But what's stemming from the question is, okay, once you ask, then what are you going to do about it? And it's the what you do about it that becomes problematic in our current climate.
That is true. But the point is that if we have leadership at the top in the state that is willing to sacrifice people's lives, should we just continue to let them do that? I mean, this is really crazy. You know, to have people, I mean, I consider vaccinated people in to be, I mean, they are carriers of this disease. they are killers. I mean, I'm sorry to use this language, but they basically feel that they can inflict it and they won't die because they are young, but there are other people who would die and maybe they deserve to die. That's the kind of attitude that these people have. And I don't think we should sit down and take it. I think we need to push in whichever way we can. What we are hoping is that a mask mandate is established at all campuses. And then I think we don't have as much fear as we do right now. If everyone wears masks, I think the chances of catching COVID goes down. This is what we are hearing. This is a scientific fact. And so if the net outcome of this is an agreement on mandate, a mandate for masks, I think we would have achieved our goals. Then we will not push on item one.
I'm just telling you, Talat, that the university does not have the authority to make that decision.
And so what do we expect then for people who find themselves in a vulnerable position? They should just be...
They wear a mask.
Yeah, but that doesn't protect them because the mask is for others. Mask really protects the others much more than it protects.
Wearing an N95 mask, you're pretty well protected. Not 100%, but you're well protected against catching it from someone else. I mean, unless you are just right in their face, but.
Well, maybe
or in a room with 300
others. We expect a response from you all. So basically, maybe we present this and then see where we go.
I will present this to the provost, but anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, I guess then item number two is just what we had before. Employees whose supervisor has determined that the employee's assignment does not require them to return to campus to work may work in a remote setting through this thing. This is again, these are employees and they don't require to be on campus and that they have worked out an arrangement with their supervisor. Okay, so that's not a major deviation. The next would be, given the uncertainty arising from COVID-19 and its variants, it is possible that assignments may change. Such changes shall be communicated to employees as soon as possible, practicable. We have it as practicable here. Then this other one basically is the same as before. This has to do with ASAP. And again, it's fine. We do expect a response from you guys. So maybe if it's fine, I don't read through it because, that's fine. I mean, we are basically putting forth what we have in mind and we expect that you will respond with what you can do. Okay. Safe working conditions, I guess, the only thing that, and John explains it here, that what we have done is added an employee's request shall be approved or denied by their supervisor and shall not be unreasonably denied. That is just to clarify. The other thing what we have done is because a good number of people who have approached us are employees who have children under 12. And so basically we have added that at-risk group or who is currently ineligible for a vaccine. So this is again talking about safe conditions here. And I think there isn't a lot of modification here. This is just a statement being added to clarify again. And then we go to office hours, and I think this is what the provost has already announced. And so it is good to have it in the MOU, so that's nothing new. This is also something that the provost has already addressed. And we can talk, the title was something we weren't sure about. So one of the ones we put here is COVID-19 affected employees. And this basically says employees who have been placed in quarantine or isolation but are feeling well enough to work may work remotely. With an instructional assignment, employees may switch their courses with a face-to-face component to remote teaching during their quarantine or isolation period. At the end of the quarantine period, the employee may resume a pre-quarantine or isolation modality. So this is what is new in what we are asking. The rest of it is what the provost has already said in his statement. Employees who cannot perform their duties due to COVID-19 or caring for an immediate family member diagnosed with COVID-19 may use leave as provided in Article 17 or request additional leave through the Nights Care Leave Share Program. The university will ensure the Nights Care Leave Share program will continue and have the ability to fulfill all employee requests throughout the duration of this agreement. So these are basically, I think, you know, I mean, again, that is something that needs to be, you need to respond to that. We are asking what we think is reasonable, but of course we will wait to hear from you. And we understand the constraints. We also think that changes are going to happen. They're going to happen at the state level. And we are hopeful that we will have a mask mandate in Florida. I know, Sherry, you may not agree with me.
I don't know. I have no idea what the state's going to do.
Yeah.
Right now, I wouldn't say hold your breath.
But I think somewhere the madness has to stop. I mean, I just don't understand why we can't do the simple thing of asking everyone to wear a mask. That's all we're asking.
So Talat, as far as the next meeting, before we meet, it would be probably nice to know who's coming or how many you expect to be there.
The one on in September, right?
Yeah, because we're going to be in person.
Right. And
right.
Right.
Yeah, you'll be the meeting room would be available for us to bargain in person. So maybe as we get closer to it, we'll figure out
sure.
how many people will be in the room so I can kind of keep an eye on space. Okay.
And one thing that we do, I think we already determined that everyone here is vaccinated.
You can stop screen share so we can.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yeah.
All right. So that's next meeting. And if you want, we can stop the recording. Oh, wait.
Oh, Robert has something.
The president.
So just quickly to follow up on your last comment, Charlie, would it be possible to do, because we don't know how many people would show up, but would it be possible to do a Zoom camera in the room if people want to see it remotely?
Yeah, I think so.
I believe that that's what the intent is to do.
Okay.
So we're gonna try to test it out, you know, next week, and then we'll let you know. But that, as I understand it, that's what we intend to do.
So some people can be in the room, and some people can.
It will be easier if I know if you're going to be in the room or not. If you're not going to be in the room presenting, I may not be there because, you know, I need to be able to see clearly what's happening. So I'm not sure. We want to test some stuff out, and I kind of wanted to get an idea. And, of course, I know that you don't know how many people are going to show up in person. I just kind of wanted to take the temperature.
I think we'll let you know a week before. Would that work?
Let's talk a week before, you know, like communicate. Yeah. And decide how we're gonna make it work. I don't want to make anyone feel forced, you know, at the change. I know change is difficult for everyone, so I want to make it easy if we can. Easy is good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you can
okay.
stop.
So does anybody from my team have anything else to add?
No, nothing here.
We actually ended it with 19 minutes in hand.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks very much. You can.
Well, thank you so much.